Hey, hello everybody. Welcome back to my basement. Yes, I'm in my happy place because it's from here, from the basement of my house, that I have the opportunity to connect with amazing experts in the communication media and the art. Those experts working behind some of your favorite TV shows, films, Broadway show, plays, artists, musicians, you name it, we have it here in the basement. I'm, of course, Francisco Suarez, your host, and this is From Suarez Basement. Today, our episode is all about production design because we have the man behind the magic of one of Netflix hit TV show, Bridgerton, is in the house. Will Hughes-Yon, the production designer for Bridgerton, is connecting from London, and he's also the production designer for a new and really cool show in Amazon Prime called My Lady Jane, which I 100% also recommend. Thank you again for tuning in. I want to welcome you, our audience, because it's thanks to your company, really, really, that we put the love, the care, and the hard work to produce this podcast. Thank you, Arane, for tuning in. Thanks to our partnership with WCNY PBS in Central New York and Central New York Art for their partnership. It's thanks to those two nonprofit organizations that we can come to you every other week. Our home in the internet, very easy, fsbasement.com. F of Francisco, S of Suarez, fsbasement.com is an awesome home in the internet where you can then find our entire library of past episodes in audio and in video, really cool educational tools. Please go and visit our home. And of course, find us all the way through all the social media. You name it. We are in Facebook, TikTok, Instagram, everywhere. Just like us, become part of our family, and we will be very happy to have you. Will Hughes-Yon is in the basement. Let's start this new episode from Suarez Basement with the production designer for the show Bridgerton and My Lady Jane Rowe. Here we go. Yep. Well, before we start, you know, going, of course, into your job now in Bridgerton, which have been such a huge success, you have been working as a production designer for many years in not only television productions in the sense of TV series, but also in films. If you could define in your own words, this is important, what is a production designer? What is your job? How would you define production design?
It's a very wide-reaching role, but ultimately the production designer is there to realize the writer and the director's vision of the piece that you're being given. So when we get a script, a production designer has their own ideas about it, and we always put those forward. Some land, some don't. And you work in collaboration with the director and the writers and the producers to create the end piece.
So what you're telling me, which is super cool, is you have in the process, you receive a script, you read the script, and you use your own imagination, your own experience, of course, to say, okay, I can propose these scenarios, right? This is how it's going to feel, how it's going to have that production. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. And very much it's a part of, I think, one of the best skills that a production designer can have is being able to read people and understand what they're thinking. Because the process of working on a job, you always generally have an interview where you have to pitch an idea. And as in recent times, it happens like this over Zoom. But in the olden days, before COVID, you used to meet in face-to-face. And that, when you're having that meeting, you can sort of tell if people are digging what you're saying or if they're not. And you have to be able to bend with the wind very quickly and understand, try and wheedle out what the writers and the producers and the director actually want. So that first meeting is essential to really understand what the piece is about from their perspective. And then you have to decide whether that's, you know, in the groove for you and whether you want to do it.
This is so interesting because I think a lot of people that are listening right now, especially students, who we put them to the process of pitching all the time and they hate the concept. It's like, yep, do I really too. Have to do it? But you have to do it, right? I mean,
yeah, absolutely. Every time. And even, you know, even on, say, the second season of Bridgerton, I obviously did the first season. And the second season, I had to pitch ideas. I was obviously going to do the second season because I didn't mess it up the first time. And they allowed me to come back, which was lovely of them. But I still had to pitch ideas. And that is a constant thing, as especially on streaming television. Quite often, you don't have all the scripts. And that's the big difference between films and TV series, is that films, you have a script and there's a beginning, a middle and an end. And therefore, at your pitch, you know the curve of the show. Whereas on a TV series or a streaming series, quite often you don't know how it's going to end. You may only get two scripts or even one. And so the process of pitching ideas and working with the people we've talked about already is a constant thing within a TV show. So, you know, if your students don't like pitching, it ain't the job for them, because you've got to keep doing it all the time.
I will promise you, and that's what I do this podcast, to educate and to inform and to inspire these students, that I'm going to make them watch this over and over again when you say exactly that, because it's true. And it's not easy. For example, of course, English is not my first language. When I start pitching in English, I remember my heart was going to get out of my chest, because I was like, do people understand what I'm saying? But more confident that you get, you know, that's the thing. You have to not only present an idea, you have to convince these people that that is the best idea for the show.
And I also feel that, you know, people think, you know, people have ideas and then they go, and this is part of my team as well. My team will come to me with an idea, and before they've even finished their sentence, they'll go, yeah, but you're not really going to like it. And you go, no, I want to hear it. I want to hear every idea you have, because no idea is a bad idea.
I agree with you.
You know, if you have ideas, get it out there. And I'm very much, as a production designer, I obviously have a very big team around me. And I say to my team all the time, no idea is a bad idea. And everybody needs to come forward with their thoughts, because what is the point of employing really creative, amazing people and then just telling them what to do the whole time? The best way is to stand back and let them shine. And on the most selfish way, it always comes back to me, or the designer, as that was a great idea. And, you know, I always try and make a point of saying most of the time, well, that was somebody else, or that was one of my team. And you push them forward. And I think ownership of an idea is really, really important, because if you own your idea, you will make it the best you can.
And I think well, I'm getting, it sounds weird, because I'm getting emotional. I'm telling you why. Because that's the point. I say to my students, it's almost like you are taking words out of me. I say to my students all the time, you are being paid and you're going to be paid because of your ideas. If you're not capable not only to bring ideas to the table, but also to express those ideas, you're going to fade in the background. Yes, you could do your job exactly what they ask you to do, but that's it.
Yeah.
People is going to pay you for your ideas. And that is incredible that you actually mentioned that, because I also say there are no bad or good ideas. A first idea is a raw idea. It is what it is. We will test them, probably would say, oh my God, that was a bad idea. But the fact that you're already classifying between a good or a bad idea, for me, that doesn't make sense, especially at the beginning.
But I think also, you know, that leads on to the next sort of element of an idea, and that's being able to explain it and get it out there. And so, you know, drawing is so important, and any sort of tactile thing you can do, even if it's sticking bits of cardboard together with sticky tape and saying, you know, I think that the basic shape of this element should be like this. I can't draw it, but I can make it out of cardboard for you.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, you build on every single little thing that you have in your arsenal to get an idea across. And it can be a matter of words. It can be, you know, a series of words and some photographs that you've cut out of a magazine. And with my set deck team, we always do, for every set we do mood boards, which not necessarily say this is what's going to be in the set, but it gives you a feeling of what the set is. And then as that progresses, we'll find photographs of furniture that we're going to put in, and then that goes into the mood board. Mm-hmm. And by that time, I've worked out the sort of rough layout of the set. And then with my set decorator, we get together and we put it on plans. So we'll have, it's literally a plan with photographs of furniture and lines going to where it is on the set. And again, you know, we then generally give it to one of the set deck assistants or one of the assistant art directors who go off and put it together for us. And quite often, and not generally at the beginning of a job, but by the end of the job, the set deck assistant or the art directing assistant will turn up and there'll be something in a different place to what we actually had on the plan. And they went, yeah, we put it there, but we think it looks better here. And these are our reasons why.
Mm.
Day one of a job, nobody ever does that because they're too scared to do it. Mm. But by the end of it, they do it all the time. And that's good ideas coming to the forefront. And as I say, you know, you, when you're a student and you leave, you know, you hope that one day in a very, very short period of time, you will get to your goal, maybe production designer, maybe set decorator, maybe supervising art director. But you will always have to start in my world. You always have to start, for want of a better word, making the tea. And but if somebody makes a good tap of tea for me and they want to listen to me, then they won't be making tea for very long, because we push people. I have a phrase in my team where I push people enough to hang themselves, give them enough rope to hang themselves. And once they've got to that point, then that's where they stay until they're comfortable to move forward. So I think it's really important that everybody realizes that ideas and how you work a way out for yourself to get your ideas out there is really important. And you don't have to know how to draw. You don't. Right. Drawing is essential. But if you want to be an art director, it's sort of essential.
You need to try to communicate somehow
in
a way.
I think it's, but people shouldn't be scared about their ideas.
I agree with you, Will, a lot. And listen, now that you mentioned that you star and the cup of tea, well, my first job was, that's a different. My first job was in an advertising agency in Venezuela. So what's coffee, not tea? I used to bring coffee to my producer long time ago. But, you know, now that you mentioned your beginnings on your career, I always say, and I'm sure my audience and students have listened to me saying that, when I was a kid, one of the things I'm fascinated about the magic of television making or visual storytelling making is a production design. Because when I was a kid, I remember spending more time creating the universe of the game that I was going to play. Of course, that doesn't exist today because everybody's playing video games. But if I was going to play, policeman, I spent hours creating the police station and how it's going to feel and how it's going to look. And that was part of the game, right? So tell me a little bit about you. How did you end creating these amazing magical spaces? But I guess in some point in your childhood or when you were a teenager, you realized, okay, this is something that I would like to do.
I suppose I was probably quite late to it. Most people I know that work in this industry of my age, when I was at college, there were no courses for doing production design. So we all sort of have fallen into it. I come from a military background. My father was military. My grandfather was. It was assumed I would be in the military. And when I said to my dad, you know what, I'd like to go to art college, he sort of stopped for 5 minutes and then said, okay, what do you want to study? I said, I don't know, but I shall do a foundation course. And I did. And he then explained, you know, he sort of pushed me in some way, said that I should do ceramics because I quite like doing ceramics. So I started off doing ceramics at college, at art college. And within about 2 days of doing ceramics at art college, I realized I liked it, but I didn't want to do it. So I then transferred into, I started a degree in 3D design, which is a very broad degree. But I specialize in architecture. So I sort of trained as an architect, really. But when I was at college, there was a big housing slump. And we have fantastic, fantastic lecturers who were all really high-end architects. And the reason they were teaching us because there was no work. So they were teaching us. So I very quickly realized that maybe architecture wasn't exactly where I wanted to be, but I love the whole idea of it. And so I left college with a degree in 3D design and was going to go. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I thought film and TV was an interesting place, but I ended up going to the music industry, making tea for bands, going on tour with bands. And literally one day I went through a door in the office into another production office where they made TV shows. And they, I said, what do you do here? They told me. And I said, okay, well, yeah, I'll give that a go. You got any jobs? So I ended up making tea there. And then I found myself on a film set, just completely blown away by it. I'd never been on a proper film set before. And there was a chap standing beside me and I said to him, you know, what do you do? He said, I'm the production designer. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. What's that? And I'd seen it on the credits, but I didn't really know what it was. And he explained to me very quickly. And again, I went, got any jobs, you know? And he made me his runner in the art department. But then very quickly, he realized, one, that I could draft and draw because of my college background. And so he then upgraded me to an art department assistant. And then from there, it just sort of rolled along. And he was the guy that taught me about having enough rope to hang yourself. So he kept on pushing me until I couldn't go any further, which was about art director. And then I stayed there for quite a long time. But by that point, I knew I wanted to be a production designer ultimately. And I was very lucky. I did a job for a show where they were very appreciative of what I'd done on it. And the next job that producer got, he said, I want you to design it. And I was like, okay. So at the age of 26, I designed my first show, which won BAFTAs, not for design, but then that was me off on the road. So there's all sorts of different paths you can take to get to that goal. Quite often I say to students that come straight from college to work for me, don't set your sights on being a production designer, because you will probably find another job within the art department that you prefer to do. Because what people don't realize about being a production designer, there's a lot of, the art directors generally have more fun. They get to do the drawing. They get to do all the cool stuff. The designer has to sit in meetings with producers and directors and argue about budgets. Well, you still have the ideas, but there's a lot of sitting in meetings.
All the administrative stuff.
And, you know, and looking at lots of administrative, but also, you know, dealing with other departments, stunt teams, special effects, CGI, you know, they all come to the designer first and foremost. And you're then the filter for the art department to disseminate the what needs to be done. So it's a great job, but it I think a lot of people have a very don't have a real clear idea what
Right. Well, I think about production in general, you know, a lot of my students, when they graduate and they go to a movie set for first time and they have been there for 5 days without showering, and you know, it's 3 in the morning, and then I don't think this is for me. I said, well, movies and TV is not as glamorous as people think. You know, it's right. Hard work. It's really, really hard work. Of course, we need to talk about Bridgerton. How not to talk about Bridgerton if this is one of the most successful, definitely, for Netflix. And the viewers, I'm in love with the characters, with the story, the way the story is told, but of course, with the production design, right? This world that you guys are creating for us, which is phenomenal. Tell me a little bit of the process of creating, for example, the Bridgerton house in compared with the neighbor house, the colors that you decide to use in each of these houses, because definitely you can see. For me, it refers old money to new money, right? It has that idea. That's so tell exactly me a little about that creative process.
So when I first got the job, I spent a lot of time with Chris Van Dusen, who was a showrunner. Mm-hmm. And we very quickly decided, we would have conversations where we'd say, okay, who are the Bridgertons? Who are the Featheringtons? What's their relationship? And we decided very quickly that it's, just to put it into some sort of context, it's like the Kennedys and the Kardashians. So it's very much the Bridgertons were very stylish and very clean cut, and the Featheringtons are a bit more brash, a bit more out there, a bit more punchy. So those were the sort of basic phrases we were using, and then we were looking at the color palette, and I, because they're different families and there are different families throughout the series, I decided, and Chris was up for us doing this, to reduce the palette of each family right down, so it became quite a defined thing. Mm-hmm. And along with the costume designer, we created this very, well, it was a Bible of colors. That, you know, the Bridgertons had these colors, the Featheringtons had these colors, and they would never cross over. As the series has gone on, they have crossed over, because ultimately there's only so many colors you can use. And it becomes more and more difficult to keep to that that ethos as the series stretches. So with the Bridgertons, we decided on this very cool blue color, principally because there's a load of pottery that was made at that time called Wedgwood, which is a very, very, very unique blue color. And as soon as I saw it, I thought, yeah, that is an object. That is a Bridgerton object. Mm-hmm. You had to describe, you know, Mummy Bridgerton in an object. That's it. So we then said, okay, it's, those are that's the base color for Bridgerton, which is this powder baby blue with a very nice sort of cream color. And then the Featheringtons, that sort of came about via the costume designer, because she was, we defined the colors very basically, and then she went for these really acidic yellows and greens and peaches. And from that, we bounced off that and created the palette for the Featheringtons. But then you get into the more sort of minutiae of it, and that's the history and how, you know, the Featherington father, you know, you had to have some sort of masculine feel to parts of the house. So we took those colors and I literally put them into a computer, and I pulled the tones down. So the same colors, just at a different tone. And those were the colors that we ended up using for, say, Lord Featherington's study and his bedroom and things like that. So you can spend hours, you know, drilling into the color palettes, but it basically boiled down to very strategic decisions about keeping the palettes narrow.
Listen, Will, I could be here with you the whole day, because this is what I love. And I appreciate your time. Unfortunately,
yeah, my pleasure.
The podcast have a very specific time. But before we go, I like to, you know, it's a little philosophical question, but hey, I like it. It's a question about Will as a person, as a professional. How do you would like to be remembered? How is something that you see in the future and you will feel like, oh, wow, you know, when the time come, year from now, I would like to be remembered.
I think there are, within our industry, there are a lot of people who are not so charitable, let's put it that way.
Okay.
And they don't, I think it's a stress thing. People don't handle stress too well.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be quite rude and poisonous and toxic. And I would like to be remembered as one of the good guys. One of the people that my team, I have a really loyal team that work for me all the time. And they will sit at home and wait for me to get jobs rather than going to work for mm-hmm. other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I would like to leave is a group of people like-minded like me who do good work, don't take life too seriously, and have fun. Because ultimately, if you can't have fun at work, you know, you spend so many years mm-hmm. at work away from your families and away from your loved ones. And if you can't have fun whilst doing it, then you shouldn't be doing it, because why put yourself through pain and anguish and not have your loved ones beside you? You might as well not bother. So work should be fun, and work should be, and people, I would like to be remembered as somebody that he was fun to work with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And let me tell you, like, again, I always say that I'm a little bit of a future. I can see the future in some point, but I don't know you. We just met today, but
yeah.
For me, anybody who is in a position of, I would not say power, that's not what I'm looking for. In a position like you, where you're busy, you're a busy man, you're doing things, and realize and say, no, but I can take 25 minutes to have this conversation, is already an amazing human being. Because,
but I think, well, that's very kind. But I think it's important for the students to realize that they are the people of tomorrow, and they will be in 5-10 years' time. They will be sitting where I am, and they need to remember that you have to give back to where you come from, because if you don't, the whole industry will just collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And people will forget how to do the old jobs, the things before CGI, when you used to have to do you know, glass paintings, which your students probably don't even know what a glass painting is.
Mm-hmm.
Look at Gone with the Wind. Fantastic.
Right.
When I started, that's what we used to do. And I think it's important that students realize that, you know, we are in a privileged position doing this work. And with privilege comes a certain amount of, what's the word?
Responsibility.
Exactly. Responsibility.
Mm.
And you have to be willing to talk to the young ones coming up and advise them, so they don't make, you know, drastic mistakes.
Mm,
and I think it's important. This is very important to me. And I would hope that, you know, it's been some use to you.
Oh, my God. Thank you so much. Of course. And before I go, what do you think about my production design?
I have to say, I'm loving the Muppet on the top. Yeah, is that Sesame Street?
Well, it show a little bit my personality, you know, like you say.
Yeah,
I don't take life too seriously. I have pictures of my family, so
perfect.
This is my...
I, on the other hand, have got some very strange things. I've got
you have a sword, a hat.
That was given to me by my prop team.
Oh, that's so cute.
When it was when we were going through a very hard time on Bridgerton, and we were at war. So like, we're at war now.
That's fantastic. Will, thank you so much. All the best in your future career. Hi to the family and keep health. And thank you for the kindness and the time.
No, my pleasure.